Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Deep Water, a program on religion, culture, and public affairs. The theme of the program is that we, as faith communities, are only in our social ministries up to our ankles. We ought to be over our heads. Today's panelists are Rabbi Jim Morrell of Temple B'nai Torah in Bellevue, and Jeff Siddiqui, a member of the Greater Puget Sound Muslim Community. My name is Don McKenzie, and I'm minister and head of staff at University Congregational United Church of Christ here in Seattle. One of the conversations that has happened since September 11th has been centered on the question of violence and the possibility that some form of nonviolent resistance might be the answer to what people are calling breaking the cycle of violence. And by the cycle, they mean that even though it often appears that immediate goals are met through violent means, whether it's in war or even intimate human relationships, that does not end that method of solving problems. Another way to say that is that problems are not ultimately solved through violence. The world has already experienced the power of nonviolent resistance through Gandhi in India in the 40s and through Martin Luther King Jr. in this country in the 60s in the Civil Rights Movement. So I thought we might explore that a little bit today and see what's on your minds and the minds of the people you are in touch with on this topic of violence versus nonviolent resistance, breaking the cycle of violence, and what could we do to implement such a dramatic change in our culture. Jim, let's start with you.
Well, I was reading an article on Friday in the New York Times written by a black South African who talked about how South Africa was able to break the pattern of violence when the nation changed from apartheid to democracy under Nelson Mandela. And Mark Mathabain was saying that when he was a child growing up, he learned how to hate, and his initial tendency was to approve violent means of resisting apartheid. But over time, he came to understand that violence was not the way to go, and South Africa is probably one of the most amazing examples where there was a peaceful, relatively peaceful transition from a very oppressive society to a society that worked on the principle of reconciliation and forgiveness. So here we have an example of a whole nation which made a transition, became a totally different place without resorting to overwhelming violence, although the violence was part of the change. But once the change took place, people vowed that violence and revenge was not going to be part of their reality. And so even people who were complicit in the apartheid reign, if they were willing to own up to their mistakes, were given a chance to enter into the society. And that took a lot of courage. So I think that the same thing could be true in our own country, in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, or anywhere else where people are willing to try a different way and of peace, nonviolence, and reconciliation. Now, it's not an easy path.
It's probably the greatest test of a person's ability to forgive is to break the violence, the cycle of vengeance. Because the first thing that comes to our mind when we hear or see or read of a violent story of involving injustice, I read one story about Pakistan involving deep injustice and criminal behavior on the part of some tribal people. And I still, this has been many days since, and it still flashes in my memory, and I feel sick and I feel angry and I feel like I could do all kinds of evil things to those people who committed the evil. And I have to stop and think that that would not do anything except perpetuate the might is right rule that seems so pervasive in our society. I grapple with it almost daily and admire people and groups that can forgive, not forget, but can forgive and move on and say, let us start again as brothers and sisters under the same sun. It is admirable. I wish more people could even think of doing that, let alone doing it.
Don, what's your take on it?
Well, you know, one thing I hear quite a bit is, well, we don't want to be pacifists. We don't want to just lie down and do nothing. And whether pacifism really means that, I'm not sure. But I do know that nonviolent resistance is an active response. It's not passive in the sense of doing nothing. And yet I'm not clear about all the things that might come under that heading. But I do feel very strongly that it does offer the kind of opportunity that the writer of the piece that you read, Jim, refers to, that people do have to learn to hate, and we could learn something else, some other way of solving problems. Because with the exception of these two places in the world, in India and this country in the civil rights era, to my knowledge, nonviolence has never been used effectively on a wide scale as a means of solving problems over and over again. And when we consider all the places in the world where violence is happening and what a tragedy that is, we have to ask ourselves, I think there must be another way. There must be another way to handle this. And exploring the possibility of nonviolence, I think, is mandatory. It probably always has been, but for some reason, I think it has gotten the attention of religious and faith communities more since September 11th because of the shock of that violence and the visibility of it and the wish that the response could be something other than continued violence such as the war in Afghanistan.
If you look at these situations, though, there is a third influence on the cycle of on peaceful transitions. It's not simply a Gandhian or a Martin Luther King's idealistic nonviolent behavior that brings in the change. If you look at South Africa, if you look at India, each time the oppressor in South Africa, the white South African regime, had been sapped of all its strength because there was no infusion of capital coming in. In India, the oppressor, the British regime, had been sapped of all its strength because it had just fought a catastrophic war, Second World War. And so their resistance levels were extremely low. And then when they met with this move for change, they had to give. Before that, if you go into India a little bit before World War II, you see that the British were not very gentle in their means to suppress resistance. So we need, I think, the powerful and the economically strong countries need to stand behind that and move against oppressing people and say, we need you to stop and move that change, not just, oh, please, will you stop, but actually what I'm suggesting is, whether we are individuals or whether we're groups or whether we're nations, it's perhaps up to each one of us to take that step and apply pressure from our side on behalf of the oppressed against the oppressor, non-violent pressure, mm-hmm. and say, you will stop. And that might then bring in that change.
The economic process, which you saw in the South, Birmingham, it was significant. You saw it in South Africa particularly, that the world community said, we're not going to trade with South Africa. The Sullivan principles that we instituted here in America, that really put the pressure on the white minority government to say, we really cannot continue. So economic pressure is good. Pressure to have elections, to really have democracy, which is also what happened in South Africa. When there's a tyrant, Saddam Hussein in Iraq is a tough issue, because the boycott that we have against Iraq does hurt the average person, children. He's not an easy person to deal with. We'd say, well, we have to have democracy, but not a tendency towards democracy. And so another thing that I read in the Friday newspaper is that the United States has this massive program of attacking Iraq. I mean, you know, all the plans are on the piece of paper. I mean, hundreds of thousands of troops. And so I said, well, we have got to the point, we've given up on all the other things to try to get him to change his attitudes. It creates a dilemma, because terrorism, oppression of his own people, Kurdish people there. So we have a dilemma of how to change a regime that is really one person who seems to have totalitarian control over a nation, which is different than a lot of other situations. Like Afghanistan, that wasn't really the case, and you know, whether we succeeded or not. So, but economics, I think, are beginning pressure, but sometimes you say, we've tried everything, or they would say, we've tried everything, and we haven't been able to succeed.
I would suggest that violence is a shortcut to effort, and the problem, take Saddam Hussein. We need to look into our own conscience and our own actions. We were the ones who put him in place. We were the ones who put him in power. We were the ones who gave him the money and the military strength. We talk about Kurds, but we supply all the weapons to kill Kurds as long as those weapons are used by Turkey. So, you know, our own behavior is not exactly clean hands.
That's true.
We need to be the motivating factor over there. And Saddam is just one manifestation. If we want to change something in Iraq, perhaps we should effect a more moral change somewhere around Iraq, maybe try to affect the state of the Kurds in a positive way rather than directing them against Saddam. And then we would become a moral beacon with some moral pressure, and perhaps Saddam can be taken out of power without use of force.
Mm-hmm. That would be a good goal. Very positive.
What is it that gives a man like Saddam Hussein his power?
Corruption and support from those that can help him maintain his power. In the past, that those who supported him have been the British and the United States. Once you put a corrupt, morally bankrupt person in power, it is very hard to get him off the track. But that's what puts him in power.
And part of the power that he wields is the assumption that he has the ability to imprison or physically harm people who disagree with him.
unfortunately, as do we these days.
Yeah. So the question is then, how might a program of nonviolent resistance reduce or even take away that power, both in terms of the people of Iraq, the Kurds, and the people of this country? I mean, my sense is that there's a way to do that, because he is frightening for several different reasons. But I keep coming back to the idea that the fear that I have of someone like that is rooted in his ability to frighten me.
I would suggest it's rooted in our ability to frighten our citizens using him as a tool. It's a convoluted thought, but really Saddam was not scary to us until we decided he was a bad guy. Saddam has not changed from day one. What has changed is our attitude towards him. He was fine when we were bolstering him up. He was fine when we were trying to kill as many Iranians as we could using his weapons as our support. But then when we saw this guy does not toe our line, we suddenly decided to let the public know truly what a demon he is. And so I suggest to you that your fear of Saddam is more your reaction to what our government is telling us. And our government uses, if I may use the term, selective righteousness, which is not a good way to, in my opinion, breaking cycle of violence or breaking cycle of revenge or to have a moral approach to anything.
The part of the fear that we have, which is I think a legitimate fear, is the fact that we introduced nuclear weapons to the world in World War II, and from that point on, the prospect, the specter of nuclear weapons makes someone who doesn't really have a lot of military power outside of his own country, like Saddam Hussein, much more frightening. Because as the number of nuclear powers increases, India, Israel, Pakistan, maybe Iran, maybe North Korea, maybe Iraq, and the delivery of these weapons, we have a sense that there would be mass destruction. And we use the expression, the weapons of mass destruction. And that's particularly frightening because I don't think anybody really has an understanding of what it is, what it would be like, except for Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We have that image, but what would it be to have a nuclear bomb exploding on an airplane or a World Trade Center as opposed to, you know, what we've experienced on September 11th, which was terrible but very limited, but a nuclear weapon. So I think part of the cycle of violence is the escalation of the effect of violence. So that makes people more afraid. And it's true that we support dictators if they're serving our purposes. But a dictator with a nuclear weapon is different than a dictator with a few bombs or guns. It's totally different. And so I like what Don you have to say about an active, nonviolent response, and yet I can also see why some people might say, "Well, that's naive," in this world where nuclear weapons. You know, Martin Luther King on a bus in Birmingham, a nuclear bomb, that doesn't seem like an equal power.
Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right. That is one place anywhere. Anywhere where the argument in favor of nonviolent resistance is extremely difficult, because it would mean the willingness of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people to endure suffering or death in the face of the possibility of a nuclear or nuclear explosions. We have to keep asking ourselves, Is the possibility that the cycle of violence could be broken, is that possibility, would it be enough over some period of time to encourage that many people to say, even if there's a nuclear weapon involved, I'm still going to be nonviolent for the sake of those who come after us and for the well-being of creation? I can see why some people would say that's naive, but I would say that for me, as a Christian person, that is at the heart of what I understand the message of Jesus to be about. The familiar phrase from the Sermon on the Mount, which is a collection of sayings, is love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, which goes against or runs counter to every piece of conventional wisdom that was present when it was spoken and even today. And yet we have to ask ourselves, is there something in that that has something to offer us, some drama of being radical enough to change things permanently? Is there anything in Judaism or Islam that suggests anything like that, with that kind of drama?
I think that it's the message of pacifism is very much in the prophetic world view. You should beat your swords into plowshares, your spears into pruning hooks, that you shouldn't have weapons. In other words, don't have weapons. Mm-hmm. That the wolf will lie down with the lamb, the lion with the suckling kid. There is that wonderful vision. The only question is how we're going to affect it. And, of course, the biblical point of view is that God will bring it about in God's time, perhaps through a Messiah or a prophet or someone like that, you know, Muhammad, Jesus, someone like that in this Christian and Muslim tradition. And yet the prophets have come and gone, and still we have this world that is violent. So we're still saying, well, it's not here yet. Now what can we do? But the vision is definitely there. I mean, that's a wonderful vision. Take all your weapons and melt them down, because you can use them for such much better purpose. The metal can be used to create food for the hungry. Now, that's a great vision, and Sermon on the Mount is a great vision. And the question is it a vision for the here and now, or is it a vision for some far-off era of peace that we're far from? But, if we said now is the period, now is the era of peace, if everybody would agree to that, then it would be.
Indeed. In the Quran, God does say, as I think he says in the Bible, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. But right after that passage of eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, right after that phrase or that sentence, it follows with, but if you forgive the sin committed against you, God will provide you with your reward, which not too many people read.
Yeah, see, I think that monotheism, which embraces Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, has this thread, this unused thread, that holds within it the possibility of a completely new direction for humanity. And it strikes me that right now, today, and I think this was brought home to many people in the wake of September 11th, that the state of the world is such that we can no longer afford, the creation can no longer afford to continue the cycle of violence, because there isn't enough energy available to humanity to deal with that. There are so many other pressing problems that have to be addressed, and they have to be addressed cooperatively. So this is a topic that I think we'll come back to, and it needs discussing and as many faith communities as possible.
Amen.
Well, that's our program for this time. Special thanks to all our listeners. Join us again next month for another Step Down into Deep Water. This program has been produced by Mike McCormick. Until next month, may God bless you and keep you.